You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
So, good evening, everyone. Welcome to this week's teleseminar. I'm Angela Murphy, Program Director for Shift in Action. Tonight, our guest is Ruth King with host Belvie Rooks. They will dialogue for approximately 40 minutes, and then we'll open up the call for your questions. So thanks for joining us, and here's Belvie.
Good afternoon or evening, depending on which coast you're on. As always, I am really excited, and I know for those of you who know our guest, Ruth King, you're as excited as I am, and for those of you who are just being introduced to Ruth and her work, you're in for a real treat. By way of introduction, Ruth is the author of Healing Rage, Women Making Inner Peace Possible, and a brand new edition of Ruth's book will be available from Penguin in August, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. She's also the president of Bridges, Branches, and Braids, which we'll also talk a little more about. And Ruth is an international facilitator, a lecturer, a life coach, and human development consultant who, as she says, weaves her background in depth psychology, leadership development, sacred dance, world travel, meditation, and teachings from Eastern and Western spiritual traditions to facilitate retreats that foster emotional integrity. She has an MA in clinical psychology from JFK University, where she served for a period as adjunct faculty in the Organizational Psychology Graduate Program. Jack Kornfeld, the world-renowned Buddhist psychologist, author, and founder of Spirit Rock Meditation Center, in reflecting on and thinking about Ruth's work, has said that, and I quote, "She articulates the painful history, patterns and traps of a raging heart and offers the skillful means for liberation." Author and Pulitzer Prize winning author Alice Walker says that Ruth's book, Healing Rage, is a classic self-help book filled with the passion, earthiness, and wisdom of a self-described wounded healer. Alice goes on to say that Ruth King's desire for wellness and freedom radiates throughout. And she ends by saying, "This is a book that can change your life." So, welcome, Ruth.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And where are you in the world, or in which continent are you traveling and lecturing on?
Right now, I'm in my home office in Berkeley, California.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes, looking out at a gorgeous evening sunset that could happen in the next hour.
Oh. Well, you begin your book, Healing Rage, which, you know, I just known about, read, and have talked to over the years so many people who have benefited both from your book and from your workshops and just from working with you one-on-one and also in an organizational context. And you begin Healing Rage with a sentence that really touched me deeply. And you say that few of us recognize the enormous power of rage as a vehicle for healing, nor do we embrace the wisdom of rage as sacred energy, and seldom do we employ rage as a means of fostering profound inner growth. Can you just begin by telling us a little bit about your background and your personal journey that kind of has led to those profound insights?
Yes, the book is quite personal, even though it's intended as service, of course, and I've certainly been in service to this vibrant emotion for many years, but it really does come out of a personal acknowledgement and honoring of the various pain patterns and generational legacies of pain from my own family.
Mm-hmm.
It started back, I think the big wake-up call came when I had open-heart surgery when I was 27 years old as a result of a mitral valve prolapse. And what happened in the course of me recovering from that very long, I think it was more like 8 weeks, just really being pretty much bedridden, and then a couple of years to really get my strength back. That life kind of changing experience where I'm on my back and I have all the time in the world to reflect on my life is when memory and rage decided to visit me in very intense ways and remind me of what I had been running from so ferociously in my life up to that point.
Well, you know, that's interesting when you talk about, you know, what you've been running from, because on the surface, you were a highly effective, functioning, professional woman working for some of the most prestigious Fortune 500 companies in the world, in the country and in the world, and coaching leaders in how to make really effective business decisions, and yet there was this...
It's all a lie, you know? Well, it's not all a lie. What's interesting and very humbling is how human we all are, and that we can do amazing things in our lives and still be haunted, like the background music in an elevator. You know, it's kind of there, but it's not ruling, but on some levels it still is.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get still, you can really sink into all that we embody. You just naturally do. That's why stillness is a big part of the healing process with this work, getting still and listening deeply.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was struck by the fact that this kind of health challenge and trauma allowed you to go deeper and to be still. And one of the things that I... was struck by as you described that recovery process, that part of how you use the time was to revisit the war zone of your childhood.
Exactly.
And can you tell us a little bit about, well, for instance, your mother. I was really struck by you say in the book that, you know, she was a civil rights activist. She fought against police brutality while at the same time
beating
all of you.
You know, there were eight of us in my family. And
mm-hmm.
High control was a big part of just keeping things in order.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was tremendous physical abuse as a form of control.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when a child is high controlled like that, I've found I'm not unique in this situation, but let me just speak for myself. Being highly controlled and physically controlled through violence or the threat of violence,
mm-hmm.
and being a fifth child out of eight, with the first six being 1 year apart,
mm-hmm.
what what I found myself doing was having this mantra of, I can't wait till I get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And what I also was carrying was grown people bigger than me get to have their way, and I can't wait to get out of here, and then I'm going to have my way.
Mm-hmm.
That's the child speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So I grow up, and of course I'm not a child, but what I'm determined to do is be in high-powered positions.
Mm-hmm.
So I get jobs that pay well, where I am an expert, and then I'm in a position to reel my rage under the umbrella of competence.
Mm-hmm.
And actually... reenact situations, and at the time it was in corporate America where I would reenact these family situations, and I got a chance to point out what was wrong as an organizational consultant and get paid well for it instead of getting beaten. And you know, I think a lot of this happens. I talk a lot in the book about disguises of rage that we wear, and we forget the pain of it, but we carry the we still embody that template and recreate the scenes. And unconsciously, we're looking for ways to have a different outcome, but it's unlikely because we're basically recreating the same drama. Because that's what we know, and that was our early definition of love, as crazy-making as that sounds.
Well, that's very interesting because I remember a few years ago, and maybe you remember this as well, when there was a book that, entitled Women Who Love Too Much, which was all a rage. And when I read the book, it was just all of this... violence and physical and emotional and psychic abuse, and I was trying to understand why anybody would replicate that. But what I came to understand from reading that book was that people are replicating what's familiar.
They're replicating what's familiar, not just because it's familiar,
mm-hmm.
but because it was swimming in love. I mean, it's often family based, and like my mother. I mean, when you are abused by somebody that you love, mm-hmm. that creates a bit of confusion,
mm-hmm.
and it's not easy to write these people off because
right.
they're a part of you. But we recreate these scenes, Belvie, in our lives and our relationships, especially in places where love, we love our work or we love our job or we love our partners and
yes.
people that our children. And yet those are the places that we act out our rage the most because the heart is involved and the heart is a wild card and the heart triggers the early memory of, oh, this is... The heart is associated with rage. The heart is associated with abuse. So people I love, this kind of fits in there. It's not conscious, but it definitely plays out. And we continue the pain patterns out of an unconscious loyalty to our parents because that was the early framing and definition of what love meant. In the book, I tell a story about a young girl who... a woman who described her young life of being physically abused by her father.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen often is then they'd go out and get ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
And people would notice the bruises and everything, and she felt awkward about that. She's 5 or 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But her daddy's holding her hand, and she's licking on an ice cream that he bought for her.
Mm-hmm.
She's in heaven,
mm-hmm.
And so it's very... we don't get to write off this foundation of love that centers around this. Rage and pain and love are very closely tied to each other. And it's not surprising for me when I look back on my life to see that I had open heart surgery,
yes.
which was rooted, I believe, in an ancestral legacy of rage. Which came through me in a form of awareness through the heart. And what I realized was open heart surgery was the beginning of a journey, a spiritual journey that really opened my heart.
I loved, I was, as I read your book, and, it's just amazing to me that such a gift in terms of your voice and your vision and the service that you provide could be rooted, and I guess that's just the reality of life's paradoxes in such pain and such a painful beginning. And I was also curious about what is the difference between rage and anger?
Yeah, it's a common question, and it's an important one. I think it's pivotal in my work. Anger doesn't haunt you as long
mm-hmm.
as rage does. And in fact, I think anger, especially perpetual states of anger, is one of the many disguises of rage that high-functioning women tend to wear.
And could you say that again?
Anger, mm-hmm. especially chronic anger, where it's your impulse to just be pissed off
mm-hmm.
about any number of things,
mm-hmm.
that is a disguise of rage. It's
mm-hmm.
one of six disguises of rage that I found to be common
mm-hmm.
Among women
mm-hmm.
and how we kind of cope. So anger oftentimes and rage get kind of thrown together as synonymous,
mm-hmm.
but it's really not. Shame is what makes the pivotal distinction between rage and anger. Shame is the twin emotion to rage. Usually, and what happens when we are in the place of rage, the sea of rage, we have this intolerable feeling of shame that we absolutely can't acknowledge. And so rage actually kicks in as a cover. And when we're in the rage place too long, shame kicks in. So those two dance together intensely. Whereas anger, we can be upset with somebody that pulls in front of us, but we're not going to be carrying that for the next several days or hours typically.
I see.
So it's subtle in that way.
In that way. Well, what are some of the kinds of traumas that you discuss that give rise to this kind of rage?
There's a number of traumas that give rise to rage, and all of them are kind of introduced to us by, and pretty well, we're kind of wrapped in whatever this disguise, this way of defending ourselves by the time we're 12 years old. Mm-hmm. So there's emotional abuse, and this is, kind of when you're put down a lot and you're expected to be a screw-up, and so you live up to it. I mean, we kind of know what that is. Mm-hmm. There's emotional neglect, which is very subtle. Mm-hmm. A lot of women have everything they could possibly think of as a child, but still felt empty and vague and absent and lonely, basically. They had a lot of things, but they didn't feel very connected. And that definitely gives rise to a lot of distortions, stories that we create about our own sense of self-worth and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, sexual and physical abuse are very much in the mix, and painfully very common, very common, you know, sadly common from people we love.
Yes.
So those are some of the forms of trauma. It can also be traumas from losing a loved one. Surprisingly, for a number of women, not so surprisingly, I guess, when I think about my own loss with my dog, is the loss of a pet or an animal that was really significant. Moving to another area and losing a lot of friends, losing your grandmother, a lot of grandmother stories came up in my research. So loss, transitions, things that knock you off, you know, human things that happen to everybody.
Right.
It's not like this is, all traumas are not necessarily the result, give birth to rage.
Right.
What gives birth to rage is how our traumas are responded to.
I see.
It's how they're responded to, because everyone has trauma.
Yes.
But it's how it's responded to that makes all the difference in the world, whether it's even seen or not, or validated, whether there's, you know, an embrace or an understanding, whether you had your voice or whether you had to shut it down.
Well, I was really, there were a couple of things that come to mind as you say that, because one of the reasons that I really appreciate your work, and particularly, you know, the work that you do both as a clinician and a counselor and is this whole issue of intergenerational trauma.
Yes.
Because often I find that, you know, that's overlooked a lot. You know, we talk a lot about personal trauma. Can you just say a little bit more about intergenerational trauma?
Absolutely. I just think it's so core to matters of rage that we understand that we carry a... it's not just the childhood traumas that give birth to rage in our own physical form. There is a rage inheritance that we also are kind of hardwired with, so to speak, when we come in here. It's the work of our parents and ancestors that hasn't been resolved, and it gets passed on to the next generation, and each generation then has an opportunity to take that to the next level. They either do that or they pass the baton to their children and their grandchildren. I mean, and it keeps on going. So, you know, we can see it easily. When I look at my own family, for example, and the fact that there was fairly severe physical abuse, and my mother working for the civil rights movement, and when you trace it back, you know, my legacies, you know, my ancestry in Africa as slaves and... Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and the beatings felt like, I felt like I was being a disobedient slave. I mean, in my stretch of that story in terms of my own experience, I can easily go there. And what I can see in my deepest bowel and understanding and gratitude of not just what I got that I didn't like, but all of the things that I got that has totally contributed to the person that I am. But I can see and bow to the legacy that's been unresolved around physical abuse as a form of control.
Yes.
And so my contribution, so to speak, is to create a service that comes from the inside out around how we befriend rage so that we don't keep passing on the legacy.
Yeah.
And we all have this in some form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether we're numb or violent or spiritless or confused, you know, I think part of it has to do with the loyalty that we carry from an unconscious legacy that's been passed down until we wake up to it.
Wow. I'm just thinking about, what a burden to carry.
It is a
burden
to carry.
Personally and collectively. And,
exactly.
And I really reverberate with that aspect of the intergenerational slavery, because this is something that's come up often as a legacy of slavery and the physical violence that just gets passed on from generation to generation. I was speaking with someone who's done a lot of work on intergenerational trauma as it relates to Holocaust survivors.
Yes.
And the fact that there are clear things that can be seen over several generations.
Yes.
So I just really so appreciate your bringing this kind of a legacy of intergenerational trauma, because I think it allows us to appreciate better in both a personal and a larger collective context what some of the benefits are of healing the rage.
Yes, and so, you know, we have this inheritance. It's not, again, just the rage. It's the humanness and the realities that we live. And as a conscious person, as a growing spiritual person, it's inevitable that we stump our toe on rage as we're healing, because it's been such a part of our survival.
Mm-hmm.
And it sits at the crossroads of our healing, and we have to bow to it and make friends with it
mm-hmm.
before we can cross into full embodiment, full light. Rage is a fire element, you know? I mean,
mm-hmm.
it brings light, it brings warmth, it brings mobility and passion. It knows a lot about the truth. It knows a lot about surviving. And it's worthy. It's an emotion that's worthy of sitting close to our ear so that we live honest with ourselves.
And that's a very subtle and profound point in your work, because you're not suggesting that we do away with... I love the image of bowing to rage.
Yeah.
And making friends with it. But you're not, you know... I mean, I love the fact that you're not, you know, just trying to eliminate it, because often... that's part of the discussion often in some New Age circles, is just getting rid of the darkness and only affirming the light and, you know, not addressing the pain.
Rage is an emotion that won't be denied. we don't have to look at it, but that doesn't mean it's not operating, because it, you know, the traumas that happen when we are early in our lives, before 12, when we're hit with these traumas, we go into a holding pattern,
mm-hmm.
and because I don't know, there's a lot of versions of this, but when I was, you know, I was slapped a lot as a child and then told to shut up,
mm-hmm.
and so that holding is still kind of in the body
mm-hmm.
until we have a safe place where we can actually release that trauma and have it complete its natural cycle. It's not meant to be held in.
I see.
But that's what we learn how to do. And some of us go out that way, you know, and it actually kills us, that holding, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of illnesses and growths and,
mm-hmm.
you know, when I had a big goiter in my throat.
Wow.
From just not speaking the truth. And a lot of women know about this.
That sense of powerlessness and how you negotiate the terrain. What is it that your book, you spend a lot of your work and is with women, and but your book is just for anybody.
It is for anyone, and men are loving it and totally identify with the disguises of rage, which are the ways we kind of keep rage under wraps,
mm-hmm.
Unfortunately at the expense of ourselves and what we want most, which is really a genuine connection with people.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, men are loving it as well.
Yeah, I totally. In fact, I was sharing your work. I shared it with someone, a friend of mine, a very good friend who's a male, and you know, he was just saying, "Where do I get this book?" And so I was just really happy to, introduce him, and also really, really happy about the response. You, talk about what some of the you mentioned. You spent a lot of time talking about what some of the benefits of getting rid of and addressing this boulder that's kind of carried on our backs, like more access to passion and creativity, and you know, more easily able to forgive. I mean,
yes.
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 Can you say a little bit more about the benefits? Because that's part of the work that you do, both individually and collectively and organizationally.
Definitely, yes. There are tremendous benefits, I think. I think a big one is when we embrace what we don't like, I think we are living more in a place of integrity in our lives, because it's not all good. You know, life is about the ride of the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the benefits of really embracing rage and sitting and watching and looking and being and acknowledging the legitimacy of it is that we're able to rest more in our own skin. We can actually find refuge within ourselves. We can rest in our own skin, in our own body and mind more comfortably. There's more space in there for us to rest. And that's a big one. I think we have more control over our lives when we're not afraid of rage, when we're not fighting it, but more able to, see what it is and why it is. I think there's more honoring of people in their fullness. In other words, when you see a person that is upset about something, you don't immediately rush to judgment. You have an empathic ability to see that and say, oh, I know that place in me.
Mm-hmm.
I know that part of me. I know it intimately. So there is a, instead of throwing gas on a fire that's already lit, you know, we are able to say, yeah, I know you. I understand what that feels like, to lose that kind of control, to be that vulnerable, to need to defend yourself. So the judgment of other people is reduced. And I think that's significant, because rage is a child emotion. It's an oppressed child emotion. And part of the problem with rage is that it hasn't been acknowledged as an energy that has actually played a role in our survival. It hasn't been acknowledged as that, although I think that's a big role that it plays. It knows how to draw a line. It knows how to say hell no.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we say these things to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's not something we want to live our lives without.
Mm-hmm.
And because we embrace rage, we know the flip side of it, which is joy and kindness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get in touch with that extreme, too.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a counter-check kind of balance going there.
Well, it's interesting, just listening to you, an idea comes to mind when you were saying about what it means not to be seen and not to be heard, and the kind of rage that is engendered often by just not being seen, not being acknowledged, not having your person or your experience or your pain. And I was just thinking that in those experiments that Dr. Emoto did with the crystals, the most distorted crystal was the ignored one. The ones that were ignored, even the ones where you shouted at them,
mm-hmm.
and said negative things were less distorted than the ignored ones, because at least there was some attention, even if it was negative.
Oh, interesting.
And I was thinking when I thought about those experiments, I was really thinking about a lot of the rage that I see so much, in a lot of I do some of this work with young people in urban in communities,
mm-hmm.
who just don't really see anything except often a stereotyped or caricature of who they really are.
Oh, yes. I was working with some young adults,
mm-hmm.
Foster kids, And, you know, by the way, our young people are really holding a big chunk of this rage for the society right now.
Yeah.
I don't think there's ever been a time where it's been this amplified, where the kids are just on fire.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a version of that when I was coming up, but it's really, I mean, I really think there's something to pay attention to. I think between the children really being highly visible and outraged, and the elders being with the increase in Alzheimer's and early signs of dementia, where there's a losing of, you know, there's something about this societally that I think is worthy of paying attention to. And I think what it says to me is that the middle group of people, and they're not claiming either of these extremes, they have to be held somewhere else in our society. So I think the young people especially are carrying a lot of the rage and really needing to be seen.
Well, it's interesting because I have a friend who does work. You know, I often do work in situations where the issues for young people are drive-by shootings and violence and gang warfare. And, you know, where in many communities young people seem to be killing each other. And I have a friend who does work the suicide hotline, and she was pointing out to me that in suburban communities often that the issue often for young people is suicide. And I was, the conversation that we were having, as you were kind of pointing out, is that if we just thought about these as our children, then that they're all our children. It just, the manifestation of hopelessness and whatever the burden is expresses itself one way with a group of young people who look this way, you know, with brown, black and brown kids often in urban communities. And in the suburbs, the kids aren't black and brown, they're white and often wealthy, but they're all in trouble.
They're in trouble, exactly. The group of kinship people I worked with recently, what was interesting was that it was hard to know who had the most rage with that group, the parents or the children. And so, I mean, I just think the role of parenting is so challenged, and I think it's a, parenting belongs to everybody in the community.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, these are our children, and the need to role model a tolerance. You know, rage is a scary emotion. Most people want to control it and make it stop.
Yeah.
Most parents have no tolerance for it coming from the children, yet it's a predictable, natural kind of emotion. So I think it's important that we learn how to not cut it off before it informs us, teaches us what it's here to let us know. And that takes some training and some practice and some skill. It's about giving up a little comfort for a bit more consciousness so that we can grow in our ability to, you know, to embrace this vibrancy so that it doesn't harm, but rather it informs.
Well, I think on that note, Angela, I mean, just that profoundly insightful note, why don't we open it up to the community at large?
All right. I will take it out of presentation mode, and when I do that, I ask that everyone who does not have a question, if you could please press *6 so that it will mute out any background noise so that we can hear the questions that are being asked and hear Ruth's and Belvie's responses.
No, we don't hear the dogs.
That's right,
exactly.
Or doing the dishes,
we
or you got it on speakerphone. All right, so it is out of presentation mode now, so go ahead and press *6. Oh, it's a lot of people on the line.
Whoa!
I love that sound.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
All right.
So who's our first person?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I meant to mute my phone, but I think I did it too early.
That's okay.
I just don't want to be a nuisance. I'm enjoying the conversation, but I don't have a question.
Okay. Well, then thank you for reminding everybody else who doesn't have a question
so
to mute.
So I just push star 6 again, right?
Star 6, yes.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Hello, if you do have a question, just say your name, please, and where you're from.
This is Dale in Portland.
Oh, great. Thank you, Dale.
Hi,
welcome.
Dale.
Would you differentiate what you talk about as healthy rage or unhealthy or destructive rage? Many people fear being out of control. Is that one of the signs, if you feel like you're out of control, that it's an unhealthy rage? What are the differences? How can a person tell whether they're having healthy rage?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Dale. And one of the ways that I work with rage is more internally before we get in a situation where we're kind of acting out on it. So I'm a few steps back before the person is actually kind of displaying. But I would say that when you are expressing anger and rage and you do feel like you're out of control, which means you don't feel good about the interaction. You're really not getting your needs met as a result of what you're doing. Then I think that would be a form of unhealthy, not for you. Now, this is a little tricky because I think there's a discomfort anytime you have a conversation about rage, whether you're in control or out of control. There's elements of it just not being comfortable. But the most important thing I think you can consider around whether it's healthy or not is if it's a pain pattern, if it's a pattern that you're repeating that is so old and you're so, like, tired of it and it still doesn't get you what you want, then that to me would be an indication of unhealthy, where it's unhealthy. Did that answer your question okay?
I
think also you mentioned judgmental. If it's aimed at destroying people,
yes,
then it's unhealthy. If it's aimed at standing up for a cause or something that's right, then I think it can be a healthy passion.
It could be a healthy passion as long as it's not harming someone else. And that's a very thin line there.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay. Next person.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. This is Nancy calling from Snoqualmie, Washington, which is east of Seattle.
And, welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I'm really interested in this topic. I'm the adoptive mother for a 19-year-old son who has been having severe rage episodes through adolescence. And we have been through hell and high water with him. He's been acting out illegally, and we've been to court a lot with him, and we've been through a couple of court-mandated anger management training programs. But even now that he's 19, he still has a really difficult time at times, not all the time. I think he's overall getting better, but at times he just doesn't seem to be able to arrest himself when he's in a rage pattern. And today, and the whole issue around boundaries comes up about, I've thought a lot about as a parent, how can I create some safety for him so that he can express some of these emotions, because he refuses to participate in therapy. He's seen 5 or 6 different therapists and refused to work with any of them. So how can I create a safe place for him to express his feelings? And when do I really need to establish a boundary around how this is not any longer frustration or disappointment or stress or anger? This is emotional abuse, and this is really unhealthy, and I need to both protect myself as a person, as a mother, in a dangerous situation, and also in some ways protect him from continuing to escalate. So today I had to call the police to intervene because, and I, I'd asked, I went on for about an hour and a half, and I kept, asking him to stop, and he kept refusing. So it's really, it's a conflicted area for me because I'm trying very hard to create safety and space for him, and I know he has a great deal of pain about being an adoptee. And he's also a different race than we are. He's Asian, we're Caucasian. So, mm-hmm. for you know, he every time he gets upset about something, he starts dredging up all this, you know, negative stuff and this distortion.
Yeah, it comes up.
And it's
up
really hard to know, you know,
yeah,
when
exactly.
should I set a firm boundary and when should I really be open and just let him express,
so
emote.
So, do you have any thoughts or ideas?
Who's speaking to
this? This is Belvy. I was just wondering, because this is just this is so common, and it takes a lot of courage. I mean, I admire your courage for calling in and raising this as a question.
Oh, thank you. It's
yeah,
hard. It's very
really,
very hard.
Really big and very fresh. If you've been going through this a bit today.
Yeah.
And it's also complex. There's a number of dimensions here
right.
around culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Around him being adopted,
mm-hmm.
and it's a lot that I don't know about, you know, what might have been done so far in terms of him having resolve around his, you know, parents, you
yeah.
know, before the adoption.
He isn't, but he won't talk about it. You know?
Okay, all
but,
right.
So I feel so stuck, you know, because I know what things could help him, but he will not accept help.
Right, so he's not willing to go there, and
right.
you're needing to set some boundaries and
I have to, yeah,
take
protect
care
myself.
Of yourself.
Yeah.
You really do have to be the adult in this situation.
Yeah.
So it would be good for you to have as much support as you can get to be able to talk about this and to have you be affirmed in terms of some of the ways you're thinking about going about solving the problem. So forms of therapy might be helpful for you
mm-hmm.
just to cope with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in terms of your relationship with him, in the book I talk about setting ground rules around rage in terms
mm-hmm.
of a new deal and, hey, this is how it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And these are, I love you, these are things I'm not willing to compromise. It's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
A common dynamic that I see with adoptive parents is a guilt dynamic that gets kicked in there,
mm-hmm.
Especially with the adoptive parents because they're wanting to do all the right things,
right.
and the children who do normal things around this age of you know testing the boundaries
mm-hmm.
Are going to see if that can be stretched as part as far as it can be sometimes.
Yeah.
So I think it's a delicate dance, and I join Belvy in honoring you for raising the issue. I think what's so important here, Nancy, is that you take care of yourself.
Yes.
And that you recognize this is where a spiritual practice also can play
yeah.
a role in terms of,
right.
like one practice I have in my life is that everybody has a destiny,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, I can't control the fate that a person, a young person, I don't care how old they are, I don't have control over where that's going.
Right.
We're all on
no.
this ride, and it's bumpy, and it's crazy, and we do what we can
mm-hmm.
And let it go. So the practice is really letting go and keeping the heart open.
Mm-hmm.
I hope this helps.
Thank you
yeah.
so much,
yeah.
Nancy, for calling.
Yeah, well, thank you.
All right.
Yeah, the things you're saying are just really hitting home around our experience
good.
The last 6 years.
Excellent.
Okay, well, good,
okay.
and thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Hello?
Yes.
Yes. This is Valerie from California.
Hmm? Where
in
California?
In Studio City. Okay.
Oh, great.
I had a question. I also have a background growing up similar to yours, and I find that, you know, in situations where they're either personal or work environments where there's a situation that I start to perceive as disempowering, I can feel that high-stakes emotional trigger that I think you're talking about with rage that starts to, you know, well. And I wonder if you could suggest, you know, what are empowering techniques that you can, you know, work with that rage? You're saying the positive sides and making friends with rage. What
oh,
are
that's
some
good.
Empowering choices to make rather than feel that sort of high stakes, all or nothing, you know, feeling that is kind of the negative side of a history of...
Got it. You can be sure that when when the heart gets pierced in that way at work or in relationships or with our kids, that's where it happens big time, that something older is operating. And it is important to kind of back up and make a decision right at that point. Is this going to be about mood or mind? You know, what's going to rule this situation? When we are feeling like the stakes are high, that means we have a big investment in what's happening. And it's important to step back and explore if the story you have about what's happening is actually true or not, or if it's the fullest truth that's possible.
Mm.
You know, I remember going to my therapist for a number of years complaining about all the racism and the white bosses and how they hated me and all this stuff. I mean, for weeks I went in there every single week, and my therapist finally said to me, "Why do you send her to the job?" And I said, "What? What are you talking about?" And after blaming her for a few minutes for such an insane question, I really had to think about it. Why do you send the raging one to the job where she's not likely to be successful with the task? And the reason I'm bringing that story in is because so often when we're triggered or when we start to feel that high intensity, a story is operating. And a story, you know, it's a rage story because the heart gets tight and the breath kind of, you can't quite put your finger on it, and you're convinced at some level that something's not right. And what's happening is we're usually looking out of a narrow lens of what a bigger story could possibly be. So the intervention or something that we can do in those moments is to ask ourselves the question, you know, how old is this situation I'm dealing with? What is this triggering in me that I might need to look at before I respond? What response can I give in this situation that would actually be kind and build a connection instead of, you know, destroy a connection? How does these things sound?
Yes, they sound great.
Okay.
You're right on. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, we need to be kind to ourselves because what we're feeling is both present and old, and we want to be able to separate the old story out so that it doesn't crowd the view and distort the view of what we're seeing.
Yeah, the old story is a lack of power.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen that I have no control over, and it's misunderstood.
And that's part of the truth. And so what you want to look at is what else is true in this moment that might actually be able to teach me something, or what else is here where I actually might be able to connect instead of close down the heart, because that trigger closes the heart, and what you want to do is keep it open and see what else is there.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Valerie.
Hello.
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 Yes.
This is from
Hello. I think. Okay. What the person? Yes.
Joy from Florida.
Uh huh. We're in Florida.
Hi.
Boca Raton.
Okay. Welcome.
Yes. It was very, very interesting what you were just saying about the heart opening, keeping it opened. What happens in a family where three sisters have the same rage? And it's over a 40-year period now where the rage, especially in holidays, has destroyed any communication whatsoever. It's so painful and so horrendous when the three share that same rage at the same time, to the point where we just can't talk to each other any longer. And we have no more words. We have no more explaining it or how to deal with it. And the heart has shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Mine hasn't, because I work at it. I've been working at it. I've been in and out of therapy for 30 years with it. I was already told what my rage can do, mm-hmm. and what I'll lose in my life if I don't understand it or work with it or control it, what I would lose. And I did lose very important things in my life because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm constantly working with it. And one of the reasons why I wanted to hear you tonight was because you brought about a word, creativity, that the energy of this rage, if I can turn it into more positive, into
mm-hmm.
a more creative avenue in my life.
Well, let me just comment. I mean, this is so important what you're saying with the three siblings. Are they all sisters?
Yes.
Yes. Three, you know, is a threshold number. So, you know, it's that just means that, you know, you're kind of wanting to move from one thing to the next. That's how I look at the number three. It's like, how do we cross the bridge somehow?
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm hearing is a lot of pain about this situation
mm-hmm.
being what it is, and that there's been tremendous effort in trying to have it be different, and it
yeah.
hasn't worked, and words are not helping and all of that.
Right.
And that it really comes to a point around the holidays.
Yes.
And one of the things you might consider, Joy, which might be kind of counterintuitive, is that this is a ritual in the family at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's holding its pattern because everybody's invested in the position they're viewing it from.
Well, the past Christmas, when it was the last big one, I noticed that the youngest sister was carrying on the tradition. It was festering. I saw it coming, and I was trying to avoid it. And the other sister was playing into it, so it was like two of them that were really stirring it up. And I saw it coming, and I was really trying to neutralize it. And then when it finally hit and it destroyed the whole holiday, the first thing that came out of my mouth was, this is traditional.
Right. This is a holiday ritual.
You're carrying it on.
You ought to tell your siblings to actually dress, to wear a costume next time that really, you know, brings it all out like the Mardi Gras. I mean, let's really dress for the role and turn it into a party. But one of the things I would recommend is that usually in a family system, there's one person that can see what's really going on while other people are not able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like you've kind of invested in. So then what the challenge then becomes, you acknowledging what it is instead of trying to change it.
Mm-hmm.
And the acknowledging of what it is with the heart, not with a story of judgment or criticism or trying to stop it or anything. See what it would be like.
For me or for the three of us?
I
know
for you.
No,
just for you.
Just for you.
Just for you.
Okay, fine. Then I have that.
You can
I have
do this.
That. I don't have them. They're
That's
not in
right.
my life.
You can do this. So you have two choices. One, you don't even have to go to the holiday. That's a choice you can make. Secondly,
I don't go anymore.
Okay. Secondly, you can go and leave your stories behind. Go as if you're meeting them for the first time. Have absolutely no expectations of them. Be in the practice of not having expectations of them. See what it's like to be curious about what they're doing as opposed to maybe... Are we still online?
Yes, we're still
online. Okay. See what it's like, you know, Joy, to be curious about, to see them like with fresh eyes without having any expectation of them being different, without any story about how they're doing it or why they're doing it. That's the role, I think, of the family shaman, the one that can see and has some skills to be able to kind of separate just a little bit so that you're not hooked. This is assuming you're not hooked into having it be different.
No, I'm not. I'm unhooked.
Yeah. So see if you can be unhooked with the heart staying engaged.
Joy, I want to thank you so much for your call this evening, and
are you talking to?
Oh, thank you so much.
You're welcome
for the call.
Okay.
Thank you for being on tonight.
Yes.
And I want to thank all of you who are just in line to ask questions. Is there someone else?
Yeah, it's Philippe from Salmo.
From where?
Salmo.
Where's that?
It's in Canada.
Oh, wonderful.
All right.
Welcome.
Okay, I have more of a lighthearted question.
Great.
I've studied a thing called personology, where it reads people's faces and body features of the body, and there's one particular trait that indicates anger or a tendency to rage, and I was wondering if Ruth has heard about this.
No, why don't you tell me about this?
Okay, what it is, you know, this is, it's the oddest thing, and I don't have any explanation as to why this is in this particular way, but I've checked it out on two or three people, and it's found to be very accurate. And so basically, if you lay your hand flat on a table, on a flat surface or something, and there's the thumb and the first finger. Now, there's three knuckles on that finger. If your thumb extends up to the lines of the middle knuckle or further, it means that you have a tendency to rage. And how I was taught is that if a person has a long thumb that comes up to that middle knuckle, that they need to get out of way, you know, physically remove themselves from a situation that causes them to get angry.
Hmm.
And because they have the tendency to completely lose their control and fly into a rage that could be quite destructive.
Well,
I want to really thank you for that kind of interesting sharing and insight, and you know, and I'm sorry we only have a couple of more minutes to kind of engage in closing, really, at this point. Though the closing isn't really a closing because we do stay on a little longer, you know, and the community continues the dialogue. And there are just so many people who want to engage in this conversation. So I'm looking forward to continuing this. Ruth, will you be able to stay on for a few minutes?
I can, and I wanted people to know about my website in case they were interested in.
Right, I was going. That's why I was trying to
kind of bring it.
In terms of closing, because
okay.
We do have some links on our on the site where this conversation is occurring. But I was going to just ask you, you know, what other links there were in addition to the healingrage.com, and if there was anything that you were doing and anything.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that are coming up this spring. Healingrage.com is definitely where you can find the details. But I have a workshop on transforming disguises of rage, which will be, both of these are in the East Bay here in in Oakland, San Francisco area. And that's April the 11th, transforming disguises of rage. It's really looking at those six disguises and turning them around. And then I have a generational healing one-day workshop, which is really transforming these pain legacies that we carry out of an unconscious loyalty to our parents and ancestors. And that will be May the 12th. And both of those are detailed on the website, healingrage.com.
Mm, I'm so excited about it. I'm trying to adjust my schedule so that I can come to one of your workshops.
That would be great, Sylvie. I would love to have you.
Well, we have another minute. And I just really want to thank you and see if there's any thing that you'd like to say in closing?
I just think it's important that we make friends with this emotion and at a deep level. And in so doing, I think we honor our ancestors, we honor our parents, and what we pass on to our children and to the people we love is a sense of pure emotion without a lot of anxiety and fear seeping into it. So I think it's really about deeper self-awareness around this emotion and working with our mind and having completing the cycle of the trauma that's still kind of hovering in our bodies. And it takes sacred environments and practice to do this. And I find it to be a life's work. And that's the part of us that we have to be willing to commit to really seeing this as something we're learning how to do for a while.
Well, I just really want to thank you for, you know, your service in this area, for the workshops that you do, for the teaching that you do, for the lectures that you do, because I feel that it serves a real purpose in kind of healing the unitary body of who we are as a collective.
Yes.
And it makes me hopeful.
Well, oh, you know, very
good. That this work is in the world and that you're in the world doing this work.
Thank you, Belzy. That's wonderful.
And I just want to thank you and encourage people to, you know, but get your book, visit your website, invite you to their town. And Angela, do you want to transition to the community dialogue, the more open community dialogue part of this?
Sure, we can do that. I'd like to thank you, Belzy, and Ruth. It was a great, great interview. Very interesting.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this offering from the Shift in Action Partners program and would like to sample more. Partners of the Institute of Noetic Sciences gain access to a weekly stream of inspiration, wisdom, media, and spirited exchange. The program includes live weekly teleseminars with visionaries who are lighting the way forward, Marilyn Schlitz, Dean Radin, Belvy Rooks, Larry Dossey, Candace Pert, Brian Swim, and many more. Our live teleseminars are then added to an extensive archive of audio and video on our website at www.shiftinaction.com, with new offerings each week from teachers like Marianne Williamson, Edgar Mitchell, and Louisa Teach. The site offers the latest in community building software that allows you to engage every piece of content as a focal point for education, exchange, and action. Join us in exploring the frontiers of consciousness.